Public speaking. I am a teacher, for God's sake. I've given my fair share of lectures. But what can I possibly say about a man I'd never met? One I didn't even know existed until a couple of days ago when I received the letter about his demise. A man who fathered me, but was never a father to me. As my feet carry me to the podium, everyone's eyes are riveted to me. Everyone but Vicky and Mr. Vaughn, whose glares are enough to send me running. Grasping the wooden edges of the podium stand, I take a deep breath as I say a couple of platitudes, just enough to give the public what they want. As Vicky and August have already said, Leo Pierce was a great man. I plaster a smile on myself, even as I feel the lie burn on my tongue. Forgive me, God. I'm standing next to your house and I'm spouting lies. Clearing my throat, I take a deep breath as I continue. He was such a great man, he left me to grow up in an orphanage. My eyes widen just as I slap a hand over my mouth. Gasps erupt everywhere, with the people on the left side staring at me as if I'd killed their cat. Yet for some reason, I can't seem to stop myself as the words pour out of me. In fact, I've never met the man. How can I say anything good about him? I know you're not supposed to speak ill of the dead and all that, but how can I sing his praises when he never once showed his face, when he never once tried to contact me? A dry laugh escapes me.
Enough, Darcy,
Mr. Vaughn says through gritted teeth. Sorry, I laughed. I shrug, giggling some more. What the hell is happening to me? But really, if he was such a family man, the best father you could have ever had, why was he not a father to me, too? I ask pointedly as I look at the Pierces. At some point, though, I must have leaned in too much. The podium wobbles, and as I try to stabilize it, I only manage to push it further until it hits the edge. When had I leaned in so much? Maybe my speech had been a little too passionate. There's that moment when I know something bad will happen, the creaking already foreboding, but the clicking sound of wood snapping against wood proves to be my doom. No sooner were the truths about my father out of my mouth than I am already falling, together with the podium stand. And it's not a pretty fall, not when the stand had been placed right behind the slightly elevated closed casket. No sound comes out of my mouth, though I could have sworn I screamed bloody murder as the stand tilts to such an angle. It crashes straight into the casket, denting the expensive wood right in the middle. Oh, dear God, please save me from this ignominy. A small yelp escapes me as I hold closely onto the podium, but though I feel the impact, there's no pain, not even one little scratch. My eyes are closed in shame, and the gasps I'd heard during my speech have now turned into wails and curses, all probably directed at me. I open one eye, furtively looking around, and it's just as I'd imagined. Mayhem. But people aren't looking at me. They're looking to my right, to... Slowly, I turn my head, my entire body freezing in place as I realize the podium hadn't just dented the casket. It had broken the hinges of the lid, sending the small piece of wood flying and revealing the dead body. I blink in shock. The body that isn't so dead. He's not, right? I stare at him just as he stares back at me, and I doubt dead people can open their eyes just as I doubt the mortician would not have closed his eyes. He's staring at me, and his nostrils flare. Come on, dead people don't breathe. You're not dead, I whisper, feeling myself sway lightly, even though I'm glued to the flat wood. He doesn't reply. Instead, he yells loudly.
Mordecai!
Dead people definitely do not speak or yell. You're not dead, I repeat like a broken record. Mr. Vaughn is by the casket in a second, hauling me up none too gently. If the fall hadn't hurt my limbs, his impossibly tight hold certainly does.
Mr. Pierce!
He exclaims, wonder tinging his voice. But as I raise my gaze to his face, I realize his eyes don't share the same surprise. Almost as if he'd known about it.
This is a miracle! A miracle, I'm telling you!
He calls out. At the same time, Vicky comes running to the casket, tears streaming down her face as she embraces her husband. I retreat to the sidelines, gawking at the show before me like everyone else around. Yet why does it feel like I'm the only one not in on the joke? Why does it feel as if this is one elaborate prank? I'm losing my mind. Either that, or they are making me lose my mind. Nonetheless, now that Mr. Pierce is clearly alive and well, and quite possibly shooting me daggers with his eyes at the moment, I can finally bid adieu to Fairydale and forget about this absolutely horrendous experience. Mr. Vaughn is helping Mr. Pierce rise from his casket, Vicky and Grace fawning over him while August is trying to convince them to give him some space. Then there's the older gentleman from before, and he's watching the entire debacle with his brows pinched, his mouth set in a grim line.
A miracle!
Both Vicky and Grace continue to exclaim, and looking around, everyone is playing along but the four people on the right, who are regarding Mr. Pierce suspiciously.
I can walk by myself, woman.
Mr. Pierce grits out, pushing Vicky off him and showing that he is, indeed, not the great man everyone was eulogizing him to be, certainly not the most polite one either. A scowl is etched on his features, and as his gaze settles on me once more, his anger becomes more pronounced. Taking a step towards me, he points his finger at my face.
You!
He sneers.
You goddamn hussy!
He spits out, the insult making me reel in shock.
Just like your fucking mother and your entire fucking family, I'll fucking show you!
He takes another step, his stride determined as he advances towards me. What the... Instead of thanking me for waking him from the dead, though I somehow doubt he was too dead in the first place, he's threatening me? My mouth hangs open in shock, and I can barely find my words to rebuke his claims. How dare he insult me like that? A hussy? I've never so much as held a man's hand. Well, fine, except Eamon's, but that was in my dream, so it doesn't count. And he dares call me a hussy? For what? For accidentally revealing his ruse to the world? A myriad of questions is going through my mind. If he's not dead, there's no will, right? And if there's no will, then why did they invite me to Fairydale? As he comes even closer, my bravado makes its appearance. After all, I won't just sit here and let him call me names when it's he who is the charlatan. How dare you! I raise my voice, my fists clenched and ready to act. This isn't a father who'd watched over his daughter and wanted the best for her, hoping to one day meet her. Malice drips from him, his eyes full of hate as he settles them on me. This man doesn't love me. He abhors me, and I have no idea why. You should have stayed dead, old man, I tell him squarely. At least then I wouldn't know what I was missing out on, I huff out loud. Everyone is gathered around us in a circle, all watching the spectacle but none daring to intervene. He's a couple of feet away from me, but as he takes another step, he suddenly stops. His eyes widen as he blinks repeatedly. His lips part, and a strangled noise erupts from his throat. Clutching his hands to his neck, he's struggling to say something, almost as if he's suffocating. Instinctively, I take a step back as he falls to his knees, the whites of his eyes turning black right before my eyes. What? I whisper, unable to believe my eyes. Hunched over, he starts dry heaving until something seems to be coming out of his mouth. Something. Everyone gasps as he proceeds to vomit his organs. One by one, he spills them onto the ground, some liquefied, some semi-solid. He retches until he's thrown up everything within him. Until he's dead. Again. Yet this time, it seems it's not enough. One second his face is frozen in time, with all the pain, shock, and agony. The next, his entire body is enveloped by black flames that swallow him whole. No one moves. Everyone watches with morbid curiosity. From the beginning, no one tried to lend him a hand. Seconds on end, the fires rage and rage, covering every inch of his skin. Then, like nothing had existed in the first place, the fire stops, his remains turning into fine dust, taken by the light summer breeze. What the hell? Am I going crazy, or did everyone else see the same thing I saw? As I lift my gaze towards the Pierce family, I'm surprised to see there's no shock, only anger, raw, palpable anger, and it's all directed at me. Witch! Vicky steps forward. You're a fucking witch! Just like your mother! Just like your entire... She doesn't finish her soliloquy as Mr. Vaughn reaches for her, restraining her in his arms and whispering something in her ear. Her mouth tightens, but she nods. This isn't the last you'll hear of me, witch, she repeats, spitting at my feet. I jump back, though I can't possibly let this rest. I'll see you at the reading of the will, I chirp, waving cheerfully as Mr. Vaughn leads Vicky and Grace away from the death scene. The rest of the people disperse, too, but not before throwing the same word around. Witch. Great. Now not only am I the outsider in this town, but I'm also a witch. I roll my eyes at the insanity, and though I've just witnessed the most grotesque show of my life, I can't find it in me to be sorry. Yes, I am shocked, but sorry? No. I hope I'm still getting the money now, I mumble sarcastically. Yet, for all my outward jolly attitude, inside my mind is clouded by doubts and confusion. Hadn't Vicky said she didn't know who my mother was? Then why pick on her to insult me, almost as if it was personal? And what about the family both she and Mr. Pierce were talking about? What else do they know and I don't? And most importantly, why am I here? When most of the crowd has moved on, I let out a relieved sigh, but I soon realized that Mr. Vaughn, who'd brought me to the cemetery, had left with the Pierces, thereby leaving me stranded here. From what I'd seen, the cemetery is located at the opposite end of town, and walking on foot to the house would probably take me an hour, at best. My shoulders slump, and just as I try to cheer myself on, someone calls me from behind.
Miss O'Sullivan.
Startled, I turn and come face to face with the people who'd been sitting on the right, a good distance away from the others. Yes? I blink, for a moment ready to hear more accusations or insults.
We wanted to take a moment to introduce ourselves and maybe offer some help.
The man says, I'm Katrina Hale. The younger girl thrusts her hand at me, her eyes sparkling with mischief. Darcy. I say, shaking her hand.
I am Connor Hale, and this is my wife, Tomasa.
Connor introduces his wife.
And that over there is my aunt, Rhiannon Hale.
Pleased to meet you. I greet them, my eyes going to Rhiannon, the elderly woman who is currently hunched over what little remains of Leo Pierce. Getting to her feet, her movements are brisk for someone her age as she comes over to our side. She doesn't speak as she simply shakes her head at Connor.
This is Darcy O'Sullivan,
he says, redirecting the old woman's attention. Oh, Darcy. Her lips tug into a welcoming smile. Welcome to Fairydale, my dear. I'm sorry you had to witness such a spectacle. I promise we don't always self-combust. I still for a moment, as it dawns on me she's joking. Releasing a chuckle, I nod. I gathered you're not fans of the Pierces, are you?
We can't say we are. But who would miss the funeral of the thorn in there?
She pauses, her eyes glinting playfully.
Bottom,
she amends, though I have no doubt she was about to use another word. I give her a tight smile.
Katrina, why don't you show Darcy around town? Get her more familiar with the surroundings.
Rhiannon suddenly suggests, all but pushing Katrina towards me. That won't be necessary. I put my hands up. I don't plan on staying much longer. Tomorrow is the reading of the will, and after that, I'm going back home. I explain. I would, however, appreciate it if you could give me a lift to the house I'm staying at. It's on the way to your house.
Is it?
Rhiannon muses in a knowing tone.
Nonsense.
Connor interjects.
Regardless of whether you leave tomorrow or not, you should still get the full fairy tale experience. Don't let this little horrific event mar your opinion of our little town.
Exactly. His wife joins in. There are a number of things you can see and do around here. All of them start talking at the same time, extolling the virtues of the town and telling me I'm missing out on a lot of great experiences by limiting myself. I guess I do need some new clothes, if you could show me a shop, I suggest. After today, I don't think I want to wear any of the clothes Grace had loaned me. In fact, aside from the reading of the will, I don't want to have anything else to do with them.
Wonderful,
Rhiannon exclaims, and based on their dynamics, I realize she's not only the matriarch, but the true head of the family. We walk over to their car, Connor and Tomasa taking the front seats, while I'm crammed with Katrina and Rhiannon in the back. They continue chatting on the drive to the town's central square, each instructing Katrina to take me to see this and that. When we finally reach the destination, Katrina and I get out of the car, but Rhiannon doesn't miss the chance to ask me to have dinner with them tomorrow night, after the reading of the will. She looks at me so expectantly that she's making it hard to say no, so I reluctantly agree. Besides, when else will I have the opportunity to see that manor of theirs up close? They drive off, and only Katrina and I are left, so I turn to her and pose the question that's been on my mind from the beginning. If you're not on good terms with the Pierces, then why are you nice to me? She laughs.
After that speech, I think it's safe to say you're not on very good terms with the Pierces either, are you?
I don't think I ever was, I murmur.
Vicky Pierce is notorious in our town for her attitude. She can smile sweetly at you while cursing you and all your past generations.
She cracks a smile. I kind of gathered that, I add dryly, thinking of my previous interactions with her.
Let's go to the shop so you can pick up a few clothes, and then let's have lunch, shall we?
She asks enthusiastically. I am quite famished, I admit. I haven't eaten anything since the night before, and truthfully, now that I know the true nature of the Pierces, I am a little hesitant to eat any of the things they've left for me in the house.
Perfect,
she exclaims, taking my arm and leading me towards a street that has a lot of colorful shops.
These are the stores. There are a few more in other parts of town, but these ones have the trendiest clothes,
she tells me as we stop in front of a store with a blue facade. There are a couple of mannequins in the window, the style of clothing agreeable, so we go inside. I browse their selection of dresses for a few minutes, and I'm pleased with their offerings and the prices. These clothes are certainly cheaper than in Boston. I don't go too crazy, though, only buying a few day dresses, some new underthings, and a nightgown. In the end, I can't pass on buying a nice, slightly more expensive dress for the dinner at the Hale Manor. Of course, not in the hopes that I will see a certain someone. Once I've paid for everything, Katrina is once more leading me down the street until we reach a diner.
This is the most popular diner in Fairydale, she says as we go inside.
The diner isn't very busy, only a couple of people inside. But the moment we step inside, their attention is riveted on us, their expressions ranging from cynical to downright dislike.
Don't worry about it, Katrina shrugs. It's not about you. My family isn't the most welcome in town.
But aren't you one of the founding families? I frown. We take our seats at the end of the diner, putting as much distance between us and the other customers. Still, the nasty glances don't stop, now coupled with rather loud gossip and bad-mouthing. And of course, it doesn't escape me when I hear the word Which? A waitress, wearing a tight smile on her face, takes our orders. I go for a roast beef, while Katrina orders a chicken casserole. When the waitress is out of hearing distance, Katrina finally turns to me.
We are, she sighs. But Nicholson rules the town. Together with Pierce and Vaughn, he's the authority around here. Compared to them, we are quite the pariahs. She smiles sadly. Most people ignore us, but there are some that make their distaste known.
She nods towards some men leering at us. Nicholson, I don't think I've met any from that family.
You saw him?
The old man in the gray suit from the funeral. Her lips curl in distaste.
He's the Nicholson patriarch, and the most influential person around here. Recalling the way Vicky and Mr. Vaughn had both reacted to him, it suddenly makes sense. They had both deferred to him as if his word was law. Mr. Vaughn told me of a conflict with the Hales, and he mentioned something about Bailey? She nods.
The Baileys are the only ones who haven't snubbed us. They don't always acknowledge us, though. But they are at least friendlier than anyone else in town.
When did this start? I don't understand why you'd stay here if everyone is so against your family, I add. I'd seen the way they were apart from everyone at the funeral, and thinking back, I could note how the others had glared at them with animosity. The reaction of the people at the diner alone is telling, but to hear that almost everyone behaves like that, I don't know if I could live in a place where everyone hated me.
When did it start?
She smiles, shaking her head. It's been like this for decades. Of course, I only know the stories from my grandmother. The Hale family settled in Fairydale immediately after the plague, soon followed by Nicholson and then Pierce and Vaughn. It's my understanding that the first conflict was over the manor and the accompanying lands. Before the plague, they used to belong to the Creed family, but everyone perished from the illness. I listen attentively, surprised to hear there was another owner of the manor, and I can't help but wonder if the Creeds were the ones who named the town Fairydale. Katrina takes a sip of water before continuing. The Hales had claim to it through Lydia Hale, the daughter of the original owners. Nicholson claimed it should have been passed down to him because he was the son of Abel Creed, but because he was illegitimate, he couldn't prove anything. Since then, they've done everything in their power to discredit us in hopes we leave Fairydale and abandon the house. And that brings me to your other question. Why stay? Because it's our legacy and our duty to stay in Fairydale. She gives me a warm smile. That's quite a tumultuous history.
And it's just the tip of the iceberg.
She groans. When they couldn't win fairly, they resorted to dirty tricks, and they've managed to convince almost everyone that we're somehow cursed and bring bad luck. Katrina shakes her head at the absurdity of it. But how could anyone believe that? We live in the 20th century. Everyone knows there's no such thing as curses. I immediately add, though the words don't feel as secure on my lips after a couple of days in Fairydale. Particularly not after witnessing Leo Pierce's wretched demise. Not only had he purged himself from inside out, but he'd also combusted right in front of us before turning into dust. Though I tried not to give that incident too much thought, I can't help but replay it in my head, marveling every time at the impossibility of the situation. This isn't Boston, Darcy. People here believe what they see. If the moon suddenly turns red, it's a bad omen. It's the same if the river changes color, or if animals suddenly die. Every little thing can be suspicious to someone who is looking for it, just like everything can seem a coincidence to someone who isn't. I nod slowly, a shiver going down my back at all this talk of witchcraft. Still, I try to ignore the odd little things that have been happening to me since I arrived in this town. I don't know if I'm yet ready to attribute that to witchcraft. What do you think happened to Mr. Pierce then? Wasn't that a little surreal? She purses her lips, the topic clearly not a welcome one.
I don't know. They've been crying wolf about us for so long, I wouldn't be surprised if it was them who engaged in God knows what. And maybe.
She pauses, bringing her eyes to mine as she regards me intently.
Maybe it was well deserved.
I blink, surprised by the conviction in her tone. I still don't understand why they called me here if he wasn't dead. Why go through all the trouble?
Perhaps they needed something from you, she suddenly adds. Something you, and only you, can provide.
But what? I ask, exasperated. I'd been trying to find an explanation for everything that's been happening, yet I keep coming up empty-handed. No matter how you look at my situation, things don't fit, and I know they will not fit until I have all the information in my hands, because as it stands, I'm reluctant to admit that I'm fully in the dark. Katrina shrugs carelessly.
Who knows? They are a weird bunch, she adds, but something about the way she's speaking suggests she knows more than she's letting on.
The food is served, and the conversation moves to a lighter subject as Katrina describes all the spots I should visit in Fairydale before I decide to leave. The waterfall and the river, the fairy hill, and of course, the Hale Manor.
We have some amazing galleries from our ancestors, as well as sculptures and priceless artifacts from the entire world. The Creeds were collectors, and everything was intact when my family moved into the manor.
Like a museum, I add in awe.
Just like a museum.
I would love to visit, I tell her sincerely. We may not have spent too much time together so far, but she's been more welcoming than anyone, and her kindness doesn't seem dependent on anything, as was the case with Mr. Vaughn and the Pierces.
There's something else I'm curious about,
I muster the courage to say as a blush stains my cheeks. I can't not ask her about her brother and what Mr. Vaughn had said. Is he dangerous? Is he trustworthy? I know war can cause trauma, and I've seen plenty of people retreat within themselves after the experience, with some turning particularly violent. Is he like that too? Despite telling myself that I should forget about him altogether, I haven't been able to. He made a strong impression on me, the likes of which I've never experienced, certainly more than any other man I've met before. And given the fact that he'd even influenced my dreams, I think it's fair to want to know more about the man. But just as I'm about to ask her about him, she suddenly stands up, her eyes growing serious.
I'll be right back, she says, as she takes off her napkin and places it on the table. I just need to take care of something, she mumbles as she all but dashes through the aisles, exiting the diner.
What? Blinking in shock, I look at the empty seat in front of me before I bring my gaze to my food and release a weary sigh. Just when I think I find a normal person in Fairydale and this happens. I take a sip of water before I signal the waitress for the check. After I pay, I finish my food and prepare to leave, since I don't think Katrina will return anytime soon. Getting up from the table, I smooth my hands over the black dress I'm wearing and grab my shopping bags. A little too excited to wear my own clothes and not Grace's hand-me-downs. I blank my expression as I pass by the other tables. More people had trickled in, and judging by their sneers, they've heard about the disaster from the funeral. The whispers don't fail to register, and out of nowhere, I feel a harsh sting on my bottom, followed by whistles.
Nice piece of ass, witch.
A man laughs, quickly joined by everyone else in the diner. Even the waitress is looking at me as if I deserved that. Gritting my teeth, I realize I can't make a scene or they will all band together against me. Already my skin is crawling from the lascivious gazes I'm getting. I release a loud huff, straightening my spine as I half-turn and hit his hand aside with my shopping bag.
Oops! I feign a smile. Careful before I put a hex on you.
I look him dead in the eye before I invent a few words in a non-existent language while pointing my finger at him.
Ashlindel Biddle Goal.
Ha! I nod to myself, bringing my finger to my lips and blowing on it as if it were a gun. If I had any doubts that these people actually believed in this witchcraft nonsense, I am now fully convinced as the man blanches right before my eyes, his breathing growing harsher as panic overtakes him. I don't stick around to see what happens, but I do hear the terror in his voice as he yells to the entire diner.
I've been cursed!
Just one more reason to cut my Fairydale visit short. Now I probably won't be able to show my face at the diner without getting doused in holy water and beaten with crucifixes. Is that even how you harm a witch? Chuckling at my own silliness, I barely get to exit the diner as a car skids right in front of me, the noise making me jump back. Dear God, I mutter, my eyes going wide. The door opens, and inside I spot none other than him, Caleb Hale. Chapter 6. He has a cigarette in his mouth, Ray-Bans perched on his nose, and a dress shirt that's been turned into a leisure outfit. The buttons on his neck popped open, his tie missing, and the sleeves of the shirt folded around his elbows. As I lean in, I can see the veins on his arms and the pure, bulging muscles.
Hop in,
he commands, in that deep voice of his that my ears have not yet forgotten. For a moment, I find myself trapped in the allure of his presence, so much so that I forget all about my abhorrence of being told what to do, even more so when I find myself sliding into the passenger seat, closing the door, and buckling my seatbelt. The interior is as luxurious as the exterior, all leather, and I'm reminded that the Hales are obviously as well off as the Pierces, if not more. Where are we going? I ask, just as my mental fog lifts, and I realize I got into a car with a stranger, putting myself in an incredibly vulnerable position.
Secret.
He winks at me, a dimple appearing in his cheek. It's not funny, I mumble, doing my best to not get caught up in his dazzling looks.
I'm not gonna murder you and hide your body, Darcy.
He half turns, amusement dripping from his voice.
If that had been my purpose, I would have had plenty of opportunities last night, wouldn't you say?
I don't answer, mostly because he is correct. It would have been entirely easy for him to do anything to me the night before. And with that house being in the middle of nowhere, no one would have been the wiser about it. But even now, having just become the hottest topic in town, and not in a positive light, I doubt anyone would care if I disappeared.
Stop worrying that pretty head of yours.
He continues as he sees my pinched brows and pursed lips. My lashes flutter in surprise as I latch on to his words, wanting to be sure he said what I think he said. You think I'm pretty? I blurt out, my cheeks turning a deep shade of red.
I didn't peg you for the type to fish for compliments, Darcy, darling.
He drawls, turning to me just as his sunglasses fall down his nose, his gaze connecting with mine. I freeze. His eyes. I could have sworn they were a light color the night before, but now they're black, pitch black.
You're staring,
he suddenly says, raising a brow. And you're not paying attention to the road, I snap, caught red-handed. His chuckle fills the air just as heat travels up my neck.
You're safe with me. Safer than with anyone else.
He tells me in a self-assured tone, one that would be cocky on anyone but him, since as he says the words, I believe them. Weird. Extremely. Not for the first time, I have to wonder what it is about him that affects me so. He'd not only prompted my fantastical dream, but also a profound loneliness, that part I'd buried long ago that only wanted to belong. Somehow, with one, no doubt inconsequential for him, meeting, this man triggered that restlessness I've always kept just beneath the surface. Whereas before, I've merely been alive, he makes me want to live. The question remains, why? Why now? Why him? You heard about that? I ask dryly, not wanting to dwell too much on what the mere sound of his voice does to my senses.
Who hasn't? By this time, everyone knows of the blue-eyed witch who made Leo Pierce self-combust.
And do you believe them? Maybe I really did it. Curse him until he became nothing more than dust in the air. He doesn't answer for a moment, his gaze focused on the road.
You don't have it in you,
he suddenly says.
You could never execute someone, could you?
He muses, posing a question for which he already has an answer. Who knows? I shrug. Maybe under certain conditions I could. He huffs at that, the corners of his mouth pulling up in a knowing smile.
I'm sure you could,
he adds sarcastically. Why do I feel like that is a challenge? I narrow my eyes at him.
Not entirely a challenge as much as...
He pauses, his eyes back on mine.
I'd be curious to see how far you can go now.
He gives me an intense look, my gaze dropping to his lips, just as he says my name in the most emphatic way.
Darcy.
Now? I frown. He merely smiles.
In the future.
He amends, flinging his cigarette out the window. Right. I'll make sure to actually bash you over the head with a metal bar next time you catch me unawares at night. I mumble under my breath. Yet everything I say seems to amuse him further. His lips are stretched in a perpetual smile, and I swear his attention is more on me than it is on the road. Not that I mind it. But I'm not sure what to make of him yet, and though his presence makes my knees weak, I need to tread carefully. Caleb, you were there last night, I start, biting my lip in apprehension. The door to the old church was open, wasn't it? I ask as I turn to him. His brows shoot up.
What? Of course not.
He answers immediately.
That place has been sealed since the plague. No one's been inside.
But I'm about to protest, but then I remember Mr. Vaughn's reaction. The last thing I want is for people to think me mad, so I keep it to myself. Maybe it was all a dream. You weren't there today. I clear my throat as I change the subject. At the funeral.
I wasn't.
He states. Why?
I'm surprised Mordecai didn't warn you away from me.
He notes, successfully dodging the question. He did. But I can make my own decisions.
Well, there you have it. If I'd shown up, there would have been two funerals instead of one. Leo's and...
Mr. Vaughn's? I ask, chuckling.
Indeed. He would have had a heart attack seeing me anywhere in his vicinity.
Why is he so against you? He sighs.
You probably noticed that he's quite close with Vicky Pierce.
He starts, and I nod.
They've been close for over 2 decades. It's an open secret.
My eyes widen with realization. I'd suspected it, but to have it confirmed. When you say 2 decades, you mean... I trail off. He wouldn't have specified the length of time if he hadn't been alluding to something, and considering Grace is around 20 years old.
I see you did the math.
So, Grace is his daughter, I say slowly, and Caleb nods. But why?
Grace has always had a crush on me,
he states matter-of-factly. But that one sentence is enough to open a chasm inside my chest. Seriously, Darcy? He's a stranger. Let me guess. You rejected her? I offer, hoping to God my tone doesn't sound so... wishful.
Yes.
He laughs, but all I feel is a strong sense of relief that fills me to the brim. Maybe I am mad, or something akin to that, for I cannot comprehend what is happening to me and why this man makes me feel so confused, yet at the same time so secure.
She didn't take it well.
He continues.
And, since our families aren't on good terms, Mordecai decided to declare open season on me for making his little angel cry.
He told me you weren't well from the war. I probe carefully, biting my lip as I watch his reaction from the corner of my eye. He doesn't get to reply, though, as he finally pulls into a small driveway. I'd been so focused on our conversation that I hadn't paid much attention to where we were going. Looking around, I note that we're no longer in the town. There is a forest to my right, and what looks like an open field across the road. Are you sure you really didn't take me here to murder me and hide my body? I joke, turning to look at him and waiting for a witty reply. Instead, I find him resting his forehead on the steering wheel, his breathing labored. He stays like that for a moment before he turns, sweat trickling down his temples, his face paler than before. Caleb? I ask as I reach out, my hand touching his for the first time. My mouth parts in a small O. Our gazes connect, just as my skin rests on top of his. He's cold. So cold. You're not well, I say, immediately placing the back of my hand to his forehead.
Just a trifle.
He strains to smile, yet I don't find any of this funny. He must have been feeling off for a while. That's why his answers were so sluggish, so... You need a medic, I tell him, when I note his forehead is as cold as the rest of his body. What if you have the flu, or worse? I babble, immediately worried.
There.
He nods behind me to what looks to be a small cabin.
Help me get... there.
I'm about to protest that he should drive to see a medic while he's still able, but one look at him and I know I won't be able to convince him.
No medic could treat this, Darcy.
He says in a soft voice.
I just... need a moment. Rest a little.
But...
Please.
He releases a harsh breath, just as blood starts dripping from his nose. My heart is in my throat as I quickly get out of the car and go to his side, opening the door and already finding him swaying on his feet as he tries to stand up. What the hell is wrong with you, Caleb? I mutter, my own limbs growing colder from the panic growing inside of me.
Language, Darcy, darling.
He chuckles, but ends up coughing instead. Coughing. Blood. How can you be amused when you... I bite my lip, willing my mind to not go there. He places his arm over my shoulder as I do my best to help him move towards the cabin. His harsh breath is in my ear, and I know this is no ploy to get me along in a secluded location. He's really ill, and I don't know how to help him. With great difficulty, I manage to get him to the front of the cabin. He pushes the door open, pointing towards a bed in the back of the room. We stagger together, and he collapses on the bed, his hand going to his chest, almost as if he's having a heart attack. Caleb, what's wrong? I ask as I kneel by the bed. Removing a handkerchief from my purse, I bring it to his face, dabbing at the blood from his nose and around his mouth. He wraps his big hand around my wrist, stopping me, and as he turns his head, his eyes open in my direction, emitting such a blinding light I'm forced to snap my own eyes shut. Caleb? I ask again, squinting. He's looking at me, but it's like he isn't seeing me. His eyes are completely white, his irises losing all their color. Caleb, I repeat, worry mounting inside of me. As if reacting to my voice, he blinks, and when he opens his eyes again, they are back to the same color as before. I exhale in relief, but that doesn't remove the anxiety I feel at seeing him in such a poor condition. Tell me how I can help, I urge in a low voice, palming his face between my hands. He looks disoriented, his pupils going in and out of focus as he simply stares at me. Shaking his head slightly, he covers my hand with his, holding tight just as he leans into me.
I won't die. I just need some rest.
He says, right before he becomes limp in my arms, his eyes closing. Panic, unlike any other, takes hold of me as I shake him, calling his name and pleading with him to react. Yet he doesn't. He's... out. Bringing my fingers under his nose, I feel for breath, calming a little as I confirm he's not dead. Wiping the rest of the blood off him, I do my best to make him comfortable on the bed while I take in the small cabin and explore its contents, all in hope I may find something to help him. Dear God, but we're God knows where. Caleb is sick. I don't know how to drive. There's absolutely no way to contact anyone in town, and he desperately needs a medic. As I look around, I notice various weapons on the wall, as well as littering every corner of the room. It dawns on me that it's a hunting cabin. But if that's so, then it should also have some medical supplies. The space is crammed, and soon I'm ransacking every little crevice, finding some canned food, ammunition, some old magazines, and eventually a small box with a red cross on it. Opening it, I can't find anything but some bandages and disinfectant, both not useful in this instance. Releasing a sigh of frustration, I gaze back at him to find even more blood pouring out of his nose, which makes my worry skyrocket. After I clean him up, I check my wristwatch, noting it's late afternoon. It will get dark soon, too. Biting my lips in consternation, I decide that instead of wasting time and praying for him to wake up, I could go into the forest and look for some plants to help. I may not be a professional, but I can recognize most medicinal plants, and if I can help him in any way. Taking only my purse with me, I follow a beaten path deep in the forest, keeping myself alert to memorize my surroundings so I can find my way back. I wander for what feels like forever when I finally spot something, red clover. A few paces over and I find even more treats, basil and horseradish. All good for cold or the flu, though I fear Caleb might suffer from a worse ailment. I pick some of each, placing them carefully in a napkin and depositing them in my purse. Suddenly, I'm glad he picked me up when he did. I may not have much worldly experience, but medicinal teas and concoctions are my specialty. If this helps him, even a little, then I'll be more at peace. As I catch sight of another plant, then another, I wander aimlessly while tucking away all types of leaves, roots, and anything I think might help. I'd carefully checked the entire place, and unfortunately, I hadn't been able to find many cooking tools aside from an old iron pot. But given that the cabin does not have any appliances, nor electricity, I won't be able to use it regularly. On my way back, I also grab a few pieces of wood for a fire, since I will need somewhere to boil the plants and make the tea. The trek back doesn't take long, and I'm thankful I haven't lost my way. As soon as I get back, I check on Caleb again, noting he hasn't woken up, his skin completely damp. Going to his side, I wipe some of the sweat away, my lips set in a thin line as helplessness overtakes me. He must have known he was ill. Then why in God's name had he brought us here instead of to a medic's office? "You can't die on me," I whisper, barely stifling the urge to shake him awake and make him promise me that. "I'm not going to let you die." Yet the issue is that I don't know what he's suffering from. My teas help with colds and respiratory ailments, but if he has neither, then I fear it is all for naught. But I can't lose hope now. Steeling myself against those intrusive thoughts, I wet a rag, placing it over his forehead while I go outside and try my best at lighting a fire. I've done it a couple of times in my childhood, but it's never an easy walk in the park. It takes me maybe 5 attempts before the flames spark to life, growing bigger and bigger as I add more wood and flammable material. After I arrange some stones in the shape of a funnel, I finally place the water-filled pot on top of it. I leave the door open to the cabin so I can see if Caleb stirs, and I glance at him every now and then. Sighing when I note no movements, I gather my dress around my legs as I lower myself to the ground, getting into a comfortable position as I go through the plants I'd collected. After I inspect them, I clean them and drop them in the boiling water. The infusion duration matters, and because some of these plants have an extremely bitter taste, I need to monitor the boiling time carefully. When I'm done, I struggle a little to pour the liquid in a mug without burning myself. I fill 2 cups to the brim, and I turn to the cabin. My eyes widen as I see Caleb awake. He's sitting on the edge of the bed, his eyes fixed on me. From that distance, I once more get the impression that he has the lightest eyes humanly possible. But as I put 1 foot in front of the other, reaching his side, I realize it must all be the play of the dimming afternoon light. His eyes are black, just like before. He doesn't make to move as his gaze follows every move I make, the intense way he's looking at me sending a shiver down my back and making me wonder if I did something wrong. "How are you feeling?" I ask, plastering a smile on my face. He doesn't return it, all amusement from before seemingly gone. Instead, there's only this nerve-wracking intensity that has me squirming on the spot. Placing 1 mug on a table, I take the other to him. "This should help you feel better," I add, as I extend the tea to him, a little nervous when he doesn't say anything. He's simply watching me like a predator would his prey. Yet before I know it, his hand is on mine, squeezing tightly and making me yelp in surprise. My eyes widen as the liquid teeters in the mug, and I do my best to stay still and not spill it, on him or on myself. "Caleb?" I ask tentatively. "What's wrong?" I whisper, seeking his gaze in an effort to understand what's happening. He doesn't answer. Abruptly tugging me to him, I don't know what I'm more shocked about, the fact that no drop of tea ever spills on my skin, or anywhere, or that I'm so close to his face, I can feel his breath on my lips.
"The tea,"
he rasps roughly, his voice thick and harsh, almost as if he hasn't used it in an eternity. "Yes, I made you tea," I say softly. I don't know what's happening to him, if this is a symptom of his illness or the onset of delirium. But as I take in his features, taut and vibrating with unreleased energy, I can't spot any of the previous signs of sickness. He's no longer pale or sweating. In fact, his skin looks golden and healthy, a natural glow to his cheeks that makes him look even more striking than before.
"The tea,"
he repeats in the same unyielding tone, his nostrils flaring.
"Have you made it for someone else?"
"What?" I blurt out, taken aback. "I made it for you, of course," I immediately say. His eyes narrow, his lush mouth tightening as he's barely holding himself back.
"That tea."
This time his voice has an exasperated quality to it.
"Have you ever made it for another man?"
he asks, just as his hold on me tightens, pulling me closer. "What are you talking about?" I whisper, and as I stare into his eyes, I could swear they flicker red. What in God's name is happening?
"It's a simple question, Darcy,"
he grits out.
"Have you, or have you not, made this for another man?"
A sliver of fear washes through me, but I push it down. Slowly, I shake my head, the word no on my lips, the softest whisper.
"Good,"
he purrs, leaning in and brushing his lips against my ear.
"You are not to ever make it for someone else."
It takes me a moment to digest his words, the fact that he's prohibiting something when he has absolutely no rights over my person. "You have no right." Just as I'm about to state my rebuke, his finger is on my lips, pushing against them and effectively silencing me.
"Right,"
he chuckles, leaning back and giving me a scathing look.
"Careful, Darcy, darling. Careful with what you say."
He enunciates each word, the message clear. I gulp down, warring with myself. I could nod and follow his cue, or I could argue, as is my instinct. Yet it doesn't escape me that he's fully recovered, strength radiating from him, or that we're alone in the woods, which I only have myself to blame for. Choosing self-preservation, I slowly give him my nod of acquiescence. His face breaks into a smile.
You're not showing me those sharp claws of yours.
He raises a brow.
Pity.
He chuckles, taking the mug from my hand and bringing it to his lips. As he removes his hold on me, I take a step back, watching him with trepidation, as if one wrong step could prove my doom. He sips the tea, yet he doesn't look away.
Only for me, isn't it, Darcy?
He raises the mug, an arrogant expression on his face as he all but dares me to contradict him. Putting on a tremulous smile, I nod. Only for you, Caleb. Yet this one interaction is enough to put a damper on my growing attraction to him. He might be handsome, but behind that perfect facade lurks something, something dark and sinister. How could I have compared him with the person in my dream? Eamon had been the true definition of a gentleman, despite disavowing the term. Though he'd killed someone to save me, his presence brought me a sense of security unlike any other. Caleb, on the other hand, he scares me, and it's not only in the way his smoldering gaze makes me fuzzy on the inside, but also in the way his intensity is terrifying me and making me fear for my safety. Going out and pretending I'm tending to the fire, I try to ignore his presence as I think of a plan of escape. God, but I need to get out of Fairydale as soon as possible.
You're no fun, Darcy, darling.
His voice echoes behind me. I don't need to turn to know he's leaning against the door of the cabin, his eyes on me. Fear courses through my veins, but I can't let it show. Not if I want to get away with both my life and my virtue intact. With the same smile plastered on my face, I address him in the softest tone. We should head back. It's starting to get dark. Dusk is already upon us, orange beams against the dark blue background. He merely raises a brow at me.
So we should,
he says slowly, and I'm taken aback by his easy acquiescence. Let me get my purse and... I don't get to finish my sentence as rain starts pouring down, extinguishing the fire and soaking me to the skin. It all happens in a matter of seconds. One moment I'm looking at him, hopeful I'll get back to Fairydale by nightfall. The next, he's before me, one with the rain. I blink, not understanding what's happening and how the weather could change like this in the blink of an eye. The sky had been clear, no cloud in sight.
You're getting wet, Darcy.
He drawls, yet he seems unbothered by the cold drops hitting his skin. And you'll get sick again, I say as I regain my wits about me. We need to leave, now. I all but grab his hand to steer him towards the car when he surprises me by swooping me up in his arms and carrying me back to the cabin. Caleb, I gasp. What are you doing? I push at his shoulders, but he won't budge, his body so hard it's as if he were made of stone. As he enters the cabin, he closes the door behind him with his foot, striding to the bed and depositing me on top of it.
There.
He smiles, wet tendrils of hair sticking to his forehead, drops of water dripping down his perfect features.
You can't be outside now,
he says, his tone gentler than before. We need to go back, I tell him emphatically. I can't stay the night out with a... man. My cheeks heat at the mention, and he smirks.
Then you shouldn't have gotten in my car in the first place, isn't that right, Darcy?
I blink in confusion, just as he leans in front of me, his knees hitting the ground just as he removes a dry towel out of nowhere and starts drying my arms.
That's not how good girls behave, is it?
Getting into strange men's cars.
He trails off as he gives me an amused look.
But you're not a good girl. You're a very, very bad girl. Aren't you, Darcy, darling?
Stop calling me that, I mutter as I remove my hand from his grasp, wishing I could get as far away from him as possible. He tips his head up, a sinister smile playing at his lips, right as he sets his eyes on me. Red, red eyes. But it's only for a second before they're back to their original black depths. Once more, I have to wonder if my mind is playing tricks on me. I don't like what you're insinuating, Caleb. I push against him.
Why?
His grasp becomes firmer, his lips pressed into a tight line.
How many other men's cars have you climbed into? How many, Darcy?
He demands in a harsh tone, one that scares me to my bones. Though I try to put some distance between us, he won't let me.
How many?
The same intensity from before appears in his face, and fear pools in my stomach. None, I whisper, hoping this would help me get out of this increasingly dangerous situation. It doesn't. Not when he smirks at me like that. Not when his hand curves along my neck, grabbing my nape and pulling me towards him. So close. So close I think he's going to force a kiss on me. Or more. I barely keep myself from trembling as I flatten my lips in a sign of rebellion. Don't. Please. I whisper, turning my gaze to his so he can see the sincerity of my plea. He muses, a low vibration in his throat that makes my body hum with unreleased tension.
I wonder, Darcy, darling.
He starts, amusement in his tone, and it's clear he's using that term of endearment mockingly.
How many men have tasted your lips?
My eyes flutter in shock at his question, and I quickly shake my head, though his hold doesn't allow for much movement. His brow goes up in question. No one. Please, let me go, I whisper, my palms on his shoulders as I push lightly. I'm not like that. Please. It takes everything in me not to cry or beg him to let me go, but I don't know how he would react to that. He's already so unpredictable, so brash. I can't take any chances with his mood changes. Yet now I berate myself for not listening to Mr. Vaughn. He may not be on my side, but he was right that Caleb isn't right in the head. He can't possibly be. My answer seems to appease him, a genuine smile appearing on his lips and lighting up his features.
That's right.
He grins, showing white, even teeth.
You're only gonna be bad for me, aren't you?
His question throws me off, and I can only stare at my disbelief. He's not going to attempt something with me, is he? He's not going to try to. I don't get to dwell on that thought as he leans in, bringing his nose to my face, breathing me in. He nuzzles his face along my cheek, skin on skin. A shudder goes down my body, yet I keep myself as still as possible.
You smell so good. Just like I knew you would.
He whispers, his warm breath on my skin.
Been waiting too long.
He murmurs, just before I feel the swipe of his tongue over my cheek. I'm 1 second away from hyperventilating, low tremors starting from my extremities and traveling all the way to my core. Think, Darcy. We should go now. I manage to get the words out in an even tone. To my surprise, he draws back, tilting his head as he regards me with an unnatural glint in his eyes, something wild and untamed. His hair damp, rain clinging to his skin and clothes. He looks like a savage, ready to make me his meal. Yet there's something more. It's in the way he's looking at me as if he can't understand me, as if human mores are beyond his comprehension.
I'll go check the car,
he suddenly says, getting to his feet and leaving the cabin. My heart is almost bursting out of my chest, and I recognize the onset of a headache. Every cell in my body is humming with terror, and not the type that I'd experienced when I heard the organ and no one was playing. No, this is something else, something primal that makes me fear not only for my life, but for my immortal soul. Despite that, I can't let myself succumb to fear. Not until I'm out of this terrible situation and as far away from Caleb Hale as possible. Yet it's not a few seconds later that he's back.
There seems to be a problem with the car,
he says, not even a twitch as he lies to my face. Of course the car wouldn't start. Isn't that the best scenario for him? Why don't you try to see what's wrong? I ask sweetly, smiling up at him. If I take the offensive, then he's likely to become more vicious as well. He nods thoughtfully.
Let me get some tools.
He goes to one of the boxes in the corner, boxes I'd well rummaged before, and removes a toolbox, taking it with him outside. Yet because I'd ransacked the entire place before, I know there are no car tools in there, just some rusty pieces of metal. He most definitely knows it, too, and is just pretending to try to fix it, to bide his time until it becomes pitch black outside. Shuffling from the bed, I look out the window and note it's still raining. Still, I can't possibly stay inside with this madman, not when it's clear his intentions are not in the least honorable. As I ease the door open, I peek outside and find him under the car's hood. That's my moment. Taking advantage of his lack of attention, I dash into the rain, running as far away from the cabin as I can. At this point, it doesn't matter if it's storming outside, or if it's about to get dark, or if there are wild animals lying in wait. Any fate is better than whatever Caleb has in store for me.
Darcy!
His voice echoes through the woods. Not even a few minutes, and he already noticed my absence. Damn it! I run faster, jumping over a log and doing my best to keep my balance as the ground becomes muddier and muddier. Fear propels me further, giving me strength even when I feel like my body is about to give up on me.
Darcy, stop!
Caleb yells after me, his voice closer and closer. I keep running.
Stop, damn it! You'll hurt yourself!
His voice barely reaches me when I trip on a boulder, my arms flailing in vain. In just a matter of seconds, I'm on the ground, the impact making me reel. Yet there's no pain. Then why are my lids so heavy? Why? Chapter 7. My eyes snap open as morning light filters through the window. As I look around, it takes me a moment to recognize my surroundings before everything that had happened the night before comes to me. Caleb, his odd behavior, him chasing me in the rain. Gasping, I stand up, a little too suddenly, and my head feels like it's about to burst. Bringing my hand to my forehead, I note there's a bandage in place. Immediately, I shoot out of bed, finding my purse and removing a small hand mirror from inside. Taking in my appearance, I note the shadows under my eyes and a splotchy red spot over white gauze. I fell. When he was chasing me, I fell. Looking around, I exhale in relief when I don't see Caleb around, and as soon as I'm able to get to my feet, I go to the door and latch the lock in place. Dear God, what happened? One glance at my wristwatch, and I note it's 8 in the morning. I spent the entire night here, with him, and I was out of it for the entire time. As things start to become clearer, I realize I'm also not wearing the same dress as before. My gaze dips down to the beige gown I'm garbed in, one of the dresses I'd bought yesterday. Yet as I move, more things hurt, including... Panic takes hold of me. Without a second thought, I slip the dress over my head, intent on inspecting my body. Tears prick at my eyes as I move my hands down my ribcage, wincing at the contact with my tender flesh. There are bruises everywhere, but that's not the worst. I swallow hard as I take in my naked body, and the fact that I'm not wearing my underthings. I'm completely bare under the dress. What makes me want to bawl my eyes out, though, is the fact that there is crusted blood all over my inner thigh, starting from the junction of my legs and drying in trickles to my knee. There are gashes and scratches all over my legs, all indicating a struggle. He... did he... A loud wail erupts from my throat as I fall down to the floor, my entire body shaking, my mind slipping from me. I don't know how long I stay on the floor, crying and sobbing from the depths of my soul. But after some time, I realize I can't possibly linger here any longer, in case Caleb returns, in case he tries to hurt me again. There is a small grace in the fact that I cannot remember what he did to me, but the evidence is clear as day. He raped me. A knot forms in my throat as I acknowledge that fact to myself, yet I have to be strong. I'm still alive, right? Finding some water, I wet a towel and try to clean myself as best as I can before I slip the dress back on, getting my purse and shopping bag before I leave the cabin. Yet as I open the door, a loud meow draws my attention to the ground, to a black cat with a small patch of white fur. You, I blink. Is it you, Mr. Meow? I ask, just as I realize how silly I am. Of course it can't be Mr. Meow, but he is cute enough to make me momentarily forget my plight. Leaning down, I beckon him closer, surprised when he lets me pet him and take him in my arms. Come with me? I ask, though I know far too well he cannot answer back. Still, he nuzzles his furry cheek against mine, and I take it as a sign of assent. Good boy, I chuckle, despite the tears still running down my cheeks. I hug the little furry creature to my chest as I trudge my way back to the village, and as I continue to cry while walking, the cat meows gently in my ear. If it had been another human, I'm quite sure it would have been a word of comfort. Thank you, I sniffle. I'm a mess today, I admit, and he snuggles closer. I'm sure you don't want to hear about my problems, but I just want to leave this damn town and forget it ever existed. Forget everyone in it existed, too.
Meow.
He releases a soft sound as he licks my cheek. I could take you with me. I'm sure I could convince Allison to let me keep you. Would you like that?
Meow.
I chuckle, though my face is still frozen with pain. I'll take that as a categorical yes. In spite of the language barrier, I'm thankful for his presence. Talking with him, despite getting no reply, is helping me to stop thinking about what happened. At the fact that Caleb... It's all my damn fault for getting in his car, for trusting him when I should have never done that. And now, another pained cry escapes my lips when I think about what he did, what he stole from me. I barely manage to put one foot in front of the other, as pain unlike any other takes root in my heart. How could he do that to me? I'd always imagined I would one day fall in love with someone, and then I'd share everything that I am with him, body and soul. Yet now there's a hollowness inside my heart when I think of someone violating my body in that manner, taking what wasn't his to take, only mine to give. My stomach rebels at the very thought, and I feel ill for even thinking him attractive, for dreaming what it might be like if he touched me. But not like that, not without my permission, and certainly not against my wishes.
Meow.
Mr. Meow licks my face again. You're a very nice cat, Mr. Meow. I coo as I give him a light pat. In an attempt to forget my sorrows, I tell Mr. Meow about my life back home, about my job and my friends, about the nuns who raised me. Recalling happy memories makes me push aside the bad ones. After what feels like an eternity, I finally make it back to the town. But because I can't quite recall where the Pierce house is, I spend another hour wandering from house to house. When I finally locate it, I knock at the door. If they yell, "Don't be too scared. Vicky tends to do that sometimes," I tell Mr. Meow. But just as the door opens, he jumps from my arms, running into the bushes. I'm about to turn to go after him when Vicky calls my name.
"And the hussy is here."
I blink. "Hussy?" I croak.
"You think we wouldn't know you didn't spend the night at Astor Place?"
She sneers.
"Who knows who the hell you slimed about with, and now I have to welcome you into my home."
She sneers before she spits at my feet. I jump a step back, confused about her attitude. That doesn't mean I'm going to let her cast aspersions on my character. "You're wrong." I push my chin up, and though I hate to lie, this instance will have to be an exception. "I slept at Astor Place. I just got home late after the Hales invited me to dinner." Her face screws in disgust, but as she mulls over my words, she doesn't try to contradict me. After all, she won't be able to confirm that what the Hales do to their enmity. "Step aside, Mrs. Pierce. I'm here for the reading of the will, and I will leave afterwards," I tell her squarely. For a moment, she doesn't seem like she will comply, but Mr. Vaughn's car stops in front of the house. As he gets out of it and comes towards us, she simply huffs her nose in the air and enters the house.
"Good morning, Miss Darcy,"
Mr. Vaughn greets, his voice tinged with suspicion.
"I dropped by your house to pick you up, but you were not there."
"I walked," I shrug.
"Nasty wound on your head,"
he suddenly mentions. "That," I unconsciously touch the bandage. "It's just a little slip."
"If you say so."
He shrugs, his eyes boring into me.
"After you."
He motions to the door, and I take a step inside. All eyes are on me, the tension palpable. They don't have to say it out loud for me to realize they somehow blame me for Mr. Pierce's death, though whose fault is it that he wasn't dead in the first place? If you ask me, I just righted a wrong.
"Right,"
Mr. Vaughn mutters.
"Let's get this over with,"
he says as he takes a seat on the armchair in the living room. I sit myself on the opposite end while the family is close to him. Grace is regarding me with pure contempt, and now even August looks as if he hates me. Of course, Vicky doesn't make it a secret that she hates me, one jibe after another coming my way. Hussy, witch, bastard. Well, I guess the third does fit.
"As all of you can attest, this document is sealed."
He removes a manila folder from his bag and shows us the official seal.
"I will now open it and read it for everyone present."
Mr. Vaughn then proceeds to read everything from the beginning. When it comes to the split of the assets, I am surprised to see just how wealthy Leo Pierce was. He left his son the majority of the stakes in a shipping company, with a few split between Vicky and Grace. Aside from that, Vicky gets the main house as well as a few properties that Mr. Vaughn enumerates. Grace, on the other hand, doesn't get anything more. Her eyes go wide when she realizes that was it for her. But if she is, in fact, not Leo Pierce's daughter, then I'd say he was already generous enough to leave her anything. My name is mentioned next.
"To my daughter, Darcy O'Sullivan, I leave the house at 12 Astor Place and the sum of $1,000,000.
I blink repeatedly, unable to believe my ears. $1,000,000? That is a sum I would have never even dreamed about. My mouth drops open in shock, but Mr. Vaughn is not done.
"With the condition that she resides in Fairydale for a total of 2 full months.
Mr. Vaughn pauses.
"Today is September 1st. You will need to reside in Fairydale until November 1st to get the allotted sum of money."
"But there was no condition for them." I point to the others.
"Leo must have wished for you to get to know the family better."
Mr. Vaughn makes the excuse, but I can't wrap my head around it. Around anything, really. Why did he pretend to be dead? I suddenly ask.
What? The gall on you, you little hussy! Vicky bursts out. How dare you besmirch my husband's name after what you did to him?
I did nothing, and you all know it! I rise to my feet, instinctively grabbing my purse and bag. And he was pretending. Let's not call it otherwise. What I don't understand is why. I say, exasperated, as I look around me. Why get me to come to Fairydale, and why make me stay another 2 months? Why was it so important for me to come here?
Leo just wanted...
Oh, please, spare me that rehearsed speech. I roll my eyes. He did not care about me one whit. So that begs the question. Why reach out at all? Just what do you want from me? Everyone is staring at me with unabashed disdain, so much so that I'm done with this. Turning, I head straight for the exit, opening the door and squinting as a ray of sun hits my retina. I barely take a few steps outside when Mr. Vaughn comes after me.
Miss Darcy, if you leave Fairydale at any point before the 2 months are up, then you're forfeiting your inheritance. All of it.
He tells me in a condescending tone. So? What is it to you? Why would you want me to stay when I can see that you dislike me? You, Vicky, and everyone in that goddamn house! I don't swear. In fact, due to my upbringing at the orphanage under the tutelage of the nuns, I've always tried to avoid doing it. But in moments when my temper is tested, like now, the bad words simply come out. Vicky doesn't tarry in joining us, too, followed by Grace and August. Let her, Mordecai. Let her leave. Let her lose the money. I don't want to see her face again in our town. Vicky rages, and before I know it, she throws a bucket of water at me. We want nothing to do with easy women around here. My eyes widen at the sudden insult, but really I should expect nothing else coming from her. Despite her initial welcome, she must have taken an immediate dislike of me for the mere fact that I am written in that will while her daughter is not.
Easy. Me? How about you look in the mirror first, Vicky dear? Your daughter doesn't look much like Mr. Pierce, does she?
Why, her eyes are the same shade as Mr. Vaughn's. Her face drops, while Mr. Vaughn's lips are pressed into a thin line.
Mom! Grace yells, clearly unaware of her true parentage. Is that true? Tell me it's not true.
Darling, I... She stammers for a moment, truly at a loss for words, before she turns once more towards me, her features filled with vitriol. One moment she's a foot away from me, the next she has her hands in my hair, pulling me with all her strength. I yelp in pain, but as I push against her, nothing works.
I should also add that by leaving, the money will go to Vicky and her daughter.
Mr. Vaughn adds from the sidelines in a bored tone, doing nothing to stop the catfight. As soon as his words register, I realize what it means for this hateful woman and her brood. And though I was reluctant to part with the money in the first place, now I get to be petty, too.
Don't worry, I say between gasps as I'm wrestling with Vicky. I'm not going anywhere. The money and the house are mine,
I add emphatically, and Vicky snaps.
You damn hussy!
She screams, about to launch herself at me once more. But before she can do that, strong arms pull me closer, easily disentangling Vicky from my side and pushing her away, hard enough that she falls to the ground.
What?
That's enough!
His voice booms, and everyone suddenly stills.
Hail!
Mr. Vaughn intones in an annoyed voice while Grace yelps,
Caleb!
Slowly turning my head, I look up and come face to face with my biggest nightmare.
Let go of me,
I sneer, ready to go into full attack mode. He leans to whisper in my ear.
Sheath your claws for now, Darcy darling. We have a show to put on.
No sooner has he said that than he redirects his attention to Mr. Vaughn.
I heard the terms of the will, Mordecai. Darcy will not leave Fairydale. As a matter of fact, she's been invited to stay with my family for the duration of the visit, and as such, she will have witnesses for the entirety of the specified duration.
My head hurts as he speaks. Stay with the family? He means me staying at the Hale Manor, where he lives, where he could have access to me as he pleases? No, categorically, no. But as I try to speak, I find that I cannot. I open my mouth, yet no sound comes out. Panicking, I look around to see that they are deep in an argument, and in a matter of seconds, Mr. Vaughn has a gun out, threatening Caleb to get off his property or he would kill him. There are also screams. Grace is crying. Vicky is yelling. August is also pointing a gun. This is hell on earth. Yet just as I think it will all blow up, Caleb swoops me up in his arms, taking me away. It's only when we're a distance away from the Pierce house that I seemingly can move and talk again. Let me go, I grit out. Surprisingly, he puts me down. Stepping away, his intense stare is on me as he peruses me from head to toe.
You weren't at the cabin when I came back.
His tone is even, his words punctuated. He's not happy with me. A shiver of fear goes down my back as I instinctively try to put more distance between us. You think